Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Lisa C., best-selling author of Snowflower and the Secret Fan and Shanghai Girls. She'll talk about her latest book, Dreams of Joy. Miss C. appeared as the featured speaker at the 2011 Great Conversations Luncheon, presented annually by the College of St. Mary. This is Miss C.'s second appearance at the College of St. Mary Great Conversations Luncheon. She was the featured speaker at the 2006 luncheon, talking about Snowflower and the Secret Fan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, March 9, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Sister Mary Ann Stevens, President of the College of St. Mary.
We're going to start by asking one of our students who's a senior in psychology, majoring in psychology. She'll graduate this May. Her name is Celine Lopez Ramos, and she's going to tell you just very briefly about her story here at College of St. Mary. So especially for those of you who have never been here before, you know really what College of St. Mary is about. The walking woman says it all. We hope to graduate women walking into the future with great courage and conviction and faith. And Celine is a wonderful example of that. So, Celine.
Welcome. It's great to be here. Thank you for the great introduction. As Sister Mary Ann said, my name is Celine Lopez Ramos. I have been at College of St. Mary's for 4 years, and I'm truly looking forward to graduating in May. I grew up in Mexico, and I moved to the U.S. and with my family in 1997. When I was 18 and preparing to graduate from Central High School, I was undecided between several options to further my education. I'm a first generation. No one in my family has ever been to college, but I really wanted to go. I came to an event here at College of St. Mary's with a couple of classmates in high school, and I was given a card of an admissions counselor with my information packet. I was told that I would be able to schedule a personal tour if I wanted one. When I left the event, I left wanting to see more of CSM. So I called and I scheduled an appointment for a tour, and I brought my mother with me. I remember feeling how the school felt like home, and I could picture myself walking the hallways of this small, familiar community called CSM. And so I did my best to get the recruiter to help me get into CSM. I was very grateful when I found that I would be able to receive financial help. My experience at CSM has been filled with a lot of personal growth. What I have learned in my books has been very important, but I also like to stress what I've learned outside the classroom. I remember coming here for welcome week, and we were sitting in the dining room right upstairs, and I even remember the menu, Chinese food. And Sister Mary Ann began to give a speech. Something she said has stuck with me throughout these years. "We're going to teach your daughters to be more assertive," she said. And on the side, she jokingly adds, "I know what you're thinking. She's already assertive enough. She doesn't need to be any more assertive." But for me, assertiveness and confidence has been something that I really needed and wanted. And she kept her promise. I am much more confident and ready to take on the world. Being more assertive is definitely one of the things that I have learned from my CSM experience that now makes a big difference in my actions, and how I view life. In high school, I barely got involved because I was shy and I feel that I wouldn't belong. Throughout my years at CSM, I have been involved in the Leadership Launch Program. I was secretary, executive, and active member of the Multicultural Association of Students, president of the Social Sciences Organization, and an active member in the Arts and Letters Club. For two of these, I received an Outstanding Club Member Award. I was also selected as a member of the Who's Who in American Colleges and Universities Association and awarded membership in the Mercy Honor Society Sigma Phi Sigma. And so here I am, 4 years later, not too different on the outside, but very different in the inside. From a shy, uninvolved girl to a woman speaking here before all of you at CSM. And I face another transition, but I know everything's going to be just fine, and I know what I have to do to get what I want. After graduating from CSM, I'm going to take a year off, study for my graduate record exam, get an internship, and maybe some work experience. And when I get to grad school, I'm going to enjoy every moment of it and continue to fulfill the dream of possibly one day becoming an author. And it all started here at CSM. I have become a walking woman striving forward to make a difference in the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Celine, for being here today and for sharing your story. We are confident that you will walk far. Now I'd like, with no further ado, to introduce Lisa C. We are honored, truly honored, to have Lisa C., author of her recent book, Dreams of Joy, with us today. Lisa was born in Paris, but grew up in Los Angeles. She lived with her mother, but spent a lot of time with her father's family in Chinatown. Her first book, On Gold Mountain, The 100-Year Odyssey of My Chinese-American Family, which was published in 1995, was a national bestseller and a New York Times notable book. That book traces the journey of Lisa's great-grandfather, Fong Si, who overcame obstacles at every step to become the 100-year-old godfather of Los Angeles's Chinatown, and the patriarch of a sprawling family. While collecting the details for On Gold Mountain, she developed the idea for her first novel, Flower Net, in 1997, which was a national bestseller, a New York Times notable book, and on the Los Angeles Times Best Books list. Flower Net was also nominated for an Edgar Award for the best first novel. This was followed by two more mystery thrillers, The Interior and Dragon Bones, and then the critically acclaimed international bestseller, Snowflower and the Secret Fan, was written in 2005, and Lisa joined us for the first time in February of 2006 at our Great Conversations event that year to share her writing of that book with us. Lisa has always been intrigued by stories that have been about lost, the lost, forgotten, or deliberately covered up, whether in the past or happening right now in the world today. Her next book, Shanghai Girls, once again delved into the forgotten history, only much closer to home, Los Angeles's Chinatown. It's a story of immigration, identity, war, and love. Peony in Love, in 2007, which was an instant New York Times bestseller, takes place in 17th century China in the River Delta and was based on the true story of three lovesick maidens who were married to the same man and who together wrote the first book of its kind to have been written and published anywhere in the world by women. Which brings us to today and the opportunity to welcome back to College of St. Mary, Lisa C., with her most recent book, Dreams of Joy. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Lisa C. Lisa.
Thank you so much. You know, it is so great for me to be back here. I'm just going to adjust this a little bit. I've been on the road for 5 weeks, and my voice is not what it was. You know, it used to be not bad, but it's not what it was 5 weeks ago. So just forgive me if I get a little cloggy every once in a while. Anyway, as I was saying, it's so great to be back here, and thank you, Sister Marianne and Kathy. You know, whatever that was, 2000, I think it was at the end of 2005, I got an email. A lot of people here today have written emails to me. I read every single email. I answer every single email. And I got this email from Kathy who said, you know, I live in Omaha and I'd really think it'd be great if you came to visit and talk about your books. And that's how we first met. And since then, I have really grown to have a group of friends here, but also this sense of belonging. And when I first started out writing, I was what they called a critically acclaimed writer. Do you know what that means? That means you get really great reviews, but nobody reads your books. And, you know, how you make that transition. We were talking about that at the table today, you know, of how you sell one book at a time and how that happens. It doesn't just happen by myself alone or even by the, you know, great quality of the writing or bad quality of the writing. It really happens because there are people out there like Kathy who said, come here to Omaha, come and do an event, and that then I can build a group of people who read these books. And as I was signing books in the line, I just was feeling, again, just so grateful to all of you and to Sister Mary Ann and to Kathy and to all the people here. And I also just want to say to Celine, just thank you for being so inspiring. You're the kind of woman who inspires me, so thank you. I thought I would start today by talking a little bit about my family. A lot of people, we're going to have a Q&A later, so I know people always ask, you know, one of the first questions is, why do you write about China? Why do you write about the Chinese-American experience? So I'm just going to get that out of the way. I grew up in a very large Chinese-American family. My great-great-grandfather was the first person in our family to come here. I like to think of this man as one of the original deadbeat dads. You know, you were supposed to come here, work hard, save up your money, and send it back home to China. Not my great-great-grandfather. He had a fondness for women and gambling, something that continues in our family even today. And as a result, his wife, my great-great-grandmother, was so poor that she used to carry people on her back from village to village to earn money to support her children. Finally, some people took pity on her and lent my great-grandfather, who was 14 years old, the money to come to the United States, what the Chinese called the Gold Mountain. And by this time, the railroad was completed. He found his father working in Sacramento. He said, you know, Dad, you're a bum. Go home. And he did. And my great-grandfather, he stayed, and he did a lot of the jobs that immigrants do even today. He washed dishes in restaurants. He swept up in factories. He worked in the fields. But by the time he was 30, in the 1880s, in Sacramento, he had his first business. And I hesitate to say it here on the campus, but what can I do? It's the truth. His very first business was a factory that manufactured crotchless underwear for brothels. Now, you know, everybody has to have their beginning in America. That's ours. Now, one day into his shop came a young woman who I think of as being quintessentially American. Her family had gone out west on the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon. They homesteaded in Oregon. We know so much about that American pioneer life and how hard it was, particularly on women. Well, her mother died when she was a baby. Her father died when she was 7. She was raised by brothers who were reputed to be quite cruel to her. When she turned 18, Ticey ran away from home. She couldn't afford San Francisco, ended up in Sacramento. And it wasn't like it is today, where if you're a young woman on your own, and worse comes to worse, you could go work at the 7-Eleven or Walmart or Starbucks, or you might be able to get a scholarship to come to a school like this. There was nothing out there. And so she ended up in Chinatown begging my great-grandfather for a job, and he hired her to sell what we called in our family fancy underwear for fancy ladies. One thing led to another, and they decided to get married. But I use that term very loosely because in California and in 28 other states, most of them in the West, it was against the law for Chinese and Caucasians, Chinese down to a quarter, to marry until 1948 in California, 1965 in many other states. It was against the law for Chinese to own property in California also till 1948, and against the law at the federal level, the national level, for Chinese to become naturalized citizens until 1943. So for these two people to get married, what they did was they went to a lawyer who drew up a contract between two people as though they were forming a partnership. They eventually moved down to Los Angeles, stayed in the underwear business for a while, gradually curios, finally into antiques. And today that business is still going. It's one of the oldest continuously owned, family-owned businesses in California. Now, my great-grandfather, he was a really interesting man. He used to sell tickets to see his stuffed mermaid. And, you know, if you come to California, if you're really lucky, I might show it to you. He was the first Chinese in America to own an automobile. He had four wives, always at least two at a time. When he lived to be 100 years old, had 12 children. The last was born when he was in his 90s, long before the age of Viagra. So a real accomplishment. And as I look around, I don't see many men. I think only one. So this should give you, sir, something to aspire to. All right, so here's the thing. As I just told that story, who's the interesting person? It's my great-grandfather, right? He's the interesting one. But really, when I think about that story, I think about my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, who carried people on her back from village to village. I think about how we tend to learn history in terms of wars and dates. But history is actually, and we tend to think about it as sort of what's out there on the front line. You know, the people who are in battle, the generals, the politicians, the adventurers, the pioneers. We hear all of those men's names. But if you just take one step back off that front line, what do you have? You have the back line. You have the back line where there are women and children and families. And it's those people who are continuing life. You know, those are the people, the women who are making sure there's dinner on the table, making sure their children are fed and clothed and taken care of and get an education, that life is continuing and culture is continuing right behind that front line. And so even all those things that are going on, wars, depressions, adventuring, being pioneers, the women and the children were there all along. And those are the stories that I'm interested in. And those are the stories that have been lost, forgotten, and deliberately covered up. I mean, they call it history, his story, for a reason. Okay? So I'm thinking about another version of history. So, which brings me to Dreams of Joy. I have been thinking of this book really in terms of four aphorisms. If you've read my books, you know that I love them and you know that I use them a lot. So the first of these is, the dead can claim the living. When Dreams of Joy opens, the daughter, Joy, has just learned certain things. That the woman she thought was her mother is actually her aunt. That the woman she thought was her aunt is actually her mother. That the man she thought was her father, who she loved so much, who's recently committed suicide, was not her father at all. Her father is actually an artist living in China. And so in a moment of sorrow and grief and guilt, and perhaps some idealism and, you know, let's be frank, a little bit of stupidity, she runs away to the People's Republic of China. It's 1957. Probably not the best idea. And I'm not giving too much away to say that by the end of the first chapter, she finds her father, and together they go out to a small village in Anhui Province where they live in a 29-bedroom, 17th-century villa from which they're going to teach peasants in the area art. Okay, hold that thought. They're out there in the village. All right, when I started Dreams of Joy, I knew that I wanted about half of it to take place in Shanghai and the other half to take place out in a small, small village in the interior of China. And as I was looking at the map of China and thinking about which province I could go to, I started thinking about the nature of Chinese written characters and how different they are from written English. You know, we can look at a word like pond, you know, you can read that word, and we will visualize, you know, a little body of water, some trees around it, maybe some fish in there. When you see that written character for pond in Chinese, first you might think of all the great ways that pond has been used in poems, in literature, in novels, in operas, you might wonder, did Lee Bai write one of his famous drinking poems by or about a pond? If you don't like literature, you might think instead of history. Was there some great battle that took place by a pond? If you don't like literature or history, you might think in terms of art. And all the great, maybe you'd think of the Song Dynasty artists who used to paint these landscapes of towering mountains, lakes, rivers, ponds, streams. The whole idea was to show the insignificance of man in the face of great nature. So this, you know, you could look at it any way. You could take that one character and have all these different interpretations. And just as a side note, this is one of the reasons why Chinese is so difficult to translate. You can give the exact same poem to 20 different translators, and it will come out very differently depending on how they choose to interpret the history behind a character. So as I was thinking about that and looking at the map of China, I thought, well, obviously I need to set this new book, part of it, in Anhui province, because Anhui is a place that is known historically for its floods, its droughts, its famines, its poverty. It's also where Pearl Buck set the good earth. And I thought, well, maybe no one else will know that. Now you do, but maybe no one else will know that, but I would, and it would give me this added depth. And so then, okay, now I'm looking at the map just of Anhui and wondering, where should this village be? Should it be in the mountains, down in the delta, out in the plains? When out of the blue, I get a call from a friend who's a writer, and you have to just forgive me for name dropping here, from Amy Tan, who says, I'm working on a new novel, and I have to go to China to do some research. And I've been invited to stay in a 29-bedroom, 17th-century villa in a small village in Anhui province. Would you like to come? And so off we went. Now, let me just say this. A 17th-century villa in Anhui is not the same as a 17th-century in, let's just say, Tuscany, you know? No windows, no heat, no hot water, no indoor plumbing. It was pretty out there. But the villa that is in Dreams of Joy is based on that actual villa where we stayed. And the village of Green Dragon is based on the actual village of Huang Sun. Okay, so meanwhile, back in Los Angeles, there's Pearl, Joy's mother. And she's reeling from all these same revelations as her daughter is reeling from. But she has something else. She is a recent widow. And that brings me to the second of these aphorisms, which is, suffering will overcome attachment by wearing it out. In the Chinese tradition, there are certain rules for widows, that you should spend the rest of your life in chastity, that you should spend your time in prayer and fasting, that you should give up all of your material possessions, and through all of your suffering, you will overcome attachment by wearing it out. But Pearl can't give up on attachment if it means giving up on her daughter. And so she, too, goes off to China, still 1957, still probably not the best idea. Now, it was really through Pearl that I wanted to look at some of our preconceptions and perhaps our misconceptions about what China was like in those days. I mean, I grew up hearing China was closed. China was closed until President Nixon opened it in the 1970s. He couldn't have opened it if it weren't closed. Well, here, and you know, when I told my mom I was going to write this, she said, oh, honey, you know, this is going to be the shortest book you've ever written. Pearl and Joy fly to China. They get off the plane. They're taken out back and shot. The end. So I knew I had to deal with that. Now, here's the thing. It was a bamboo curtain, not an iron curtain. Iron, you can't pass through. Bamboo, you can see through, you can slip through. It's pliable, it's flexible. In fact, there were a lot of people leaving China in those days, some of them legally, some of them illegally, and a lot of people going into China in those days. A lot of Westerners, for example. You've all heard of Goldman Sachs. Mr. Sachs's daughter, Mr. Sachs, you know, one of the great capitalists in the history of America, his daughter was one of these young idealistic women who ran away in 1950 to China and stayed there until she was 95. But there were also Chinese from around the world who went back to China in these days. And some of them were going back, sure, for political reasons. But mainly they were going back for a different reason. And I've used this example. Suppose that instead of all of us being here today, we were instead living in Paris as expatriates. And somehow overnight there was a big change in government here. And tomorrow when we woke up in the morning, instead of this being the United States of America, it might be the United States of fun and exciting places to visit. Not the great name for a country, but okay, we'll just go with it. And wouldn't you feel this real need to come home? Because you'd want to know what happened to your family. Is everyone okay? What happened to your house? Did you still have your job? But more than that, this is our home country. This is our home. This is your home city, your home state, your home country. And wouldn't you want to be a part of rebuilding, of turning this, the United, what did I call it? The United States of fun places to visit. Wouldn't you want to be a part of making that happen, of making sure that this became another good country that would still be our home country? And so that's why so many Chinese went back there in those days, filled with optimism, although they hit some things that were not so great. Now, certain things happened when you crossed the border. You had to turn in your passport and declare yourself stateless. If you were a woman, you had to turn in all of your bras because bras were considered decadent, bourgeois, imperialistic. So there aren't a lot of bras in this book. Now, not long after they arrive is the launch of what was called the Great Leap Forward. Now, I've always had history in my books, and this is no exception. And I've been, again, interested in history, lost, forgotten, deliberately covered up. And I'm not going to talk too much about what the Great Leap Forward was when we get to the Q&A. If somebody wants to know more, I'm happy to answer it. But I will just say this. No government starts out saying, here's a good idea, let's start a new program that's going to end up in a terrible disaster. People started with great optimism. This was going to be a great leap forward for China. It was about 60 years too early, you know, if you think of China today, which really has had a great leap forward. But this started out with this idea of increasing agriculture and steel production, you know, being able to feed everyone and being able to industrialize. It was a series of unintended consequences that ended in the greatest man-made famine in the history of the world. And people have been arguing for years, how many people actually died? Was it 10 million? Was it 100 million? And recent documents released by the People's Republic of China seem to suggest that it was about 45 million people who starved to death in 3 years. And so China at that time was not that large. You know, it was only 400 million people, a little larger than the United States is today. So think of what would happen here if we had something on that kind of scale and how that would affect every single person in this room. All right, so history. Now, how do I do my research? I go every place that I write about. I eat, until this book, I had eaten every single thing that every character has eaten in every single one of my books. And if you've read them, you know I've eaten some pretty crazy things. I talk to people who have lived through that time period. You know, I talk to scholars who can point me in the right direction. There's a man, a professor at the University of Irvine, who has spent his whole life studying Shanghai. And so he put me in contact with people who had gone into China in those years and people who had left, whether they'd left legally or illegally. But again, I also get a lot of email from people. And I, you know how, let's just say you buy a green Toyota, and then all of a sudden, everywhere you drive, you see green Toyotas? It's like the weirdest thing. So it's sort of like that when you're writing a book. You kind of become a magnet for things. We'll call it the green Toyota effect. So you kind of become a magnet. So one day, out of the blue, I get an email from a woman who says, you know, I really enjoyed Shanghai Girls because it reminded me so much of my own childhood. And her story was that Her parents were German. She was born in Shanghai. When the war came, she went back to Germany. And then in 1950, they decided to move back to Shanghai and reopen their family factory. And she stayed there until 1965. So she was there in the very years that I was writing about. I started writing her questions every day. What was it like when you crossed the border? What did you do for lipstick? What did you do for bread? How did you do this? What was in the store windows? What did you eat? What did you wear? What did you do for heat? All of these questions she would write back. And she's the one who told me that, you know, that they confiscated hers and her mother's bras. She said, and you know, we just spent the next 10 years flapping in the breeze. All right. So, again, I have a lot of history, but really what my books are about are relationships and emotions. In Snowflower and the Secret Fan, I wrote about best friends for life. In Peony and Love, there's the relationship between Peony and her mother and her grandmother. In Shanghai Girls, sisters. And now in Dreams of Joy, a mother and a daughter. Which brings me to the third of these aphorisms. Mothers suffer, children do what they want. Doesn't matter where you are in the world, it's true. Now, I am a daughter myself. I'm also a mother. Now, I suspect some of you here are not mothers, but I'm pretty sure everyone in this room somewhere along the line had a mother. And I have, you know, I have thought a lot about mothers, you know, beginning with Dreams of Joy and thinking again about my own mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother. These incredible women who are so inspiring to me and who have lived through these incredible moments of history. And I've thought a lot about what does it take to be a mother? May I just ask how many of you have read Snowflower and the Secret Fan? Okay, so most of you. So you will remember in that book, I talked about, again, another Chinese-written character for love. It's composed of two elements. One part means love, the other part means pain. Now again, Chinese is a much more nuanced language than English. In English, we can say, or I could say, you know, I love my husband and I love my sons, and I do. But I also really love ice cream, I love to travel, I love hamburgers. My husband has sometimes said to me, you know, honey, I think you love hamburgers more than me. And, you know, on some days, I do. But I'm stuck with that one word. But in Chinese, written Chinese, there are very different characters to explain these very different aspects of love. Gratitude love, pity love, respectful love. You know exactly what I mean, even though we don't actually have an equivalent in English. And then, of course, mother love. Love and pain. And when I was writing Snowflower and the Secret Fan, I thought I understood it completely, that it's how a daughter would look at her mother who is physically binding her daughter's feet, physically inflicting terrible, terrible pain in the name of love. But even by the time I'd gotten to the end of Snowflower, I knew that really mother love is something about what a mother feels for her child. And I started thinking about my own experiences. And I remembered when my son, Alexander, was a tiny, tiny baby, and he got his first ear infection. He was just, you know, like 3 weeks old. And, you know, you're up, it's 3 a.m. The baby's got a terrible fever. You're walking through the house, pat, 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 pat. You know, the baby's lying like this or crying that piteous, piteous cry. The doctor, of course, isn't calling back. And I remember just being so terrified and so scared and thinking, if I can just get through tonight, I know everything will be okay. Of course, I didn't realize then that he was going to learn how to drive. Okay, but here's the thing. You know, your kids, they grow up. They go off to college, they get married, they get jobs, they have children, they lose their jobs, they lose their houses, they might get divorces, whatever. Life happens to them. Real life happens to them. And then what do we do as mothers? And I started thinking about my younger son, Christopher, who a few years ago met a lovely, 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 lovely girl I think of as the evil Jenny. And she thought it would be a really nice idea to just rip his heart out of his chest, throw it on the ground, stomp up and down on it in her Uggs, and just, you know, he was just devastated, absolutely devastated. But then what do we do as mothers, as parents? And I remember just sitting there listening. You know, you sit, you listen, you sit, you listen, you sit, you listen. You can't go around the house patting, patting, patting like this. And finally, you start to hear these really ridiculous things coming out of your mouth, like, oh, honey, there are other fish in the sea. You know, doesn't help, because what can we do at that point? What we do as mothers is we take their pain and we carry it in our hearts. That's a mother's love. So when I think about mothers, and now we're going to just dismiss those mothers like Casey Anthony, okay? We know they're out there. But when I think about good mothers, courageous mothers, what I think of first is sacrifice, that a mother will do anything to make sure that her child is safe, happy, healthy, alive, that sometimes it takes extraordinary courage to make those things happen, and that then there is no one more loyal to you than your own mother. And my mom, when I was growing up, she used to say, you know, even if you become an axe murderer, I'll still love you. Now, I haven't yet, so I haven't tested it, but I do believe it's true. But this isn't just a one-way street. You know, we get back a lot as well. And so we learn a lot as women when we become parents. We learn how to be brave. We learn how to love without judgment. If you've ever had a wedding in your family, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We learn how to share what we know. We learn how to be patient. We learn how to have fun. I have been thinking of Dreams of Joy as really being in two parts. That the first part is about finding joy, the daughter, and the second part is about finding joy, the emotion. People often say to me, you know, your books are so sad, and you never have a happy ending. Why can't you just have a happy ending? And it's true, I don't. I really have never had a happy ending until now. But people have said, you know, they'll send me, again, emails. You know, I was on a plane, and I was reading your book, and I was crying so hard that the flight attendant came and asked, are you okay? Or, you know, I was on vacation, and I was at a beach resort, and I was by the pool reading one of your books, and I was crying so hard that the, you know, the bartender came up and asked, are you okay? And this email I do get about once a week. I was in bed last night, and I was reading one of your books, and I was crying so hard that my husband took it away from me. So I know that they're sad. But here is the thing. I have never cried when I have written them. I'm not saying it's not hard to write them, but I have never cried. And I think of it, and I know these are two different things, but I think about it, I don't know how many of you have had to take care of someone when they're dying. And, you know, and you might be at the hospice, or you might be at the hospital, or you might be in your own bedroom. And other people around you are crying and sad and worrying, but you can't do that. You have to be there. You have to be strong. You have to be the person who's in the room. You have to be the person who's the witness. That's your job, is to be the witness, to just be there. And I've done that myself, and I know what it's like. And certainly writing a book is not the same. But I do feel that these characters that I write are real people, and that my role is just to be in the room with them, just to be their witness. And I can't afford to be the one who cries and gets sad, that I just have to be there present with them, for them. So I'd never cried in any of my books until now, and it's in the happy ending, 1.5 pages from the end. And you know when you write a book, you write the first draft, and then you second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, tenth, twelfth, and then you send it off to the publisher, they send it back, then you do another three, four, five drafts, send it off to the publisher, they send it back, and then do another two or three, send it off to the publisher, then you have page proofs and copy editing, all that stuff, so that by the time I'm done with the book, I have read it from page one to the last page, I've gone through it 20, 30 times. And every single time that I would come to this one line, 1.5 pages from the end, in the truly happy ending, this weird liquid stuff started to fly out of my eyes. Which brings me to the last of these aphorisms, and it was written by a writer named Lin Yutong back in 1937. And he wrote, "There is soft happiness in sadness and deep sadness in happiness." And I believe that that's true. So I hope that when you come to the end of Dreams of Joy, that you find yourself in tears, not in sadness, but in the celebration of the triumph of happiness over sadness, in the knowledge that family matters. Perhaps it's the only thing in life that matters, and that goodness and joy and grace will triumph in the end. Thank you. Okay, so we can have some questions, and I'm going to repeat them so that everyone can hear. Oh, so she would like my thoughts on Peony and Love because she found it very unusual. And it is unusual. It is based on a true story of three women. This is in this time period in the mid-17th century in the Yangtze Delta, where there were more women writers who were being published than all together in the rest of the world at that time. Now, of course, in the rest of the world at that time, there weren't very many women being published. We could probably come up with the names of one or two nuns in Europe who were writing and being published, but that's about it. So this one area, though, had over 1,000 women who were being published, who were traveling around the country in the 17th century version of a book tour, who were supporting their families with their writing. There was a subcategory called the lovesick maidens. These were young women who loved an opera called The Peony Pavilion. They were never allowed to see it. They could only read it. And when they read that opera, they would catch cases of lovesickness, like the main character in the opera, and then waste away and die, as the character did in the opera. And as they were dying, they would write poems and stories, which were then published after their deaths. And we can still read those today in English. And so there were three of them who were married to the same man, one right after the other. Not one of them lived past 16. And together they wrote the first book of its kind to have been written and published anywhere in the world by women. And I chose to write this as actually a ghost story of I hate to give things away, but so I won't say too much, but that a lot of it is this kind of ghost story of this young girl's journey. In the Chinese afterworld. And the Chinese afterworld is very, very different than our concept of heaven. It's very different than our concept of hell. And there are a lot of rules in the Chinese afterworld that do not apply in the Western afterlife in heaven. And so this was a way for me to really explore that and to look at all of those traditions, many of which are still practiced, still believed today. And to me, you know, I've had a lot of people say to me, you know, that book, they either really love it or they really hate it, actually. And they say, that book, you know, it's not my religious belief. So I didn't like it because it's not my religious belief. But, you know, that's what I love about books. That's why I read books, is to explore lives that are different from mine. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but that was some of my thinking. Yes, Jane. What am I working on now? So in the 1930s and 40s here in this country, there were these Chinese-American nightclubs, most of them in San Francisco, one in New York called the China Doll. And then there were, you know, this was the big nightclub era, so there were nightclubs all around the country, I'm sure some right here in Omaha. And people, these performers, would go out on tour around the country. And when they did that, they didn't say, oh, we're going out on the Borscht Belt. They would say, oh, we're going out on the Chop Suey Circuit. And these people, they build themselves as the Chinese Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the Chinese Sophie Tucker, the Chinese Houdini, the Chinese Frank Sinatra, the Chinese Sally Rand. And I have been out interviewing them, these people. A few weeks ago, I was up in the Bay Area on book tour, and I got to meet the Chinese Ginger Rogers, 92 years old. Turns out she's not Chinese, though. She's Japanese, but okay. I also met in Los Angeles a woman named Mai Tai Singh, 88 years old now. The Mai Tai, the drink, was named for her. And these women, as they keep saying to me, you know, once a showgirl, always a showgirl. They're in their 80s, 90s. They are so glammed out. They're just so totally glamorous. And as Mai Tai kept saying, well, you know, I always loved glitter. And she's like, and you could see I still wear a lot of bling. I love it. She's 88. Okay, so at one point I asked her, what was your favorite costume all the years you were dancing? You know, remember, this is sort of that Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers era where they wore those beautiful, beautiful gowns. And the men are in top hat and tails. And she said, oh, that's easy. My favorite gown was made out of monkey fur. I couldn't even make that up. You know, you couldn't make that up. So I'm having a wonderful time with it. And so this is going to be the story of three friends who are in that world, who've come from very different backgrounds, and, you know, what happens to them over about 10 years. Who determines the cover of my books? The publisher. I can have some input. So actually, for Shanghai Girls, at one point my editor said, you know, I don't really understand this whole thing about the beautiful girls. What are they? I don't, you know, I talk about them, but what are they? And so I did some color Xeroxes of different poster art from that time period, sent it to him, and about 18 months later, I was still working on the book, I get in the mail two sample covers, and both of them were from images that I had sent him. So sometimes, you know, they don't ask me anything, and sometimes I've actually chosen the art.
A member of the audience next asked, of all the books you've written, which do you consider your greatest accomplishment?
That's actually a very hard question, because how do you weigh accomplishment? You know, can I have two? I mean, actually, I really do think all of them. It's kind of like with your kids, you know, that's, you're asking me in a way like, which was your favorite child? Depends on the day. But you do love them and care about them in different ways, and each one has a different challenge and a different thing that I feel. So I'll just say two. With Snowflower and the Secret Fan, with that book, as I said at the very beginning, I was, you know, what they call a critically acclaimed writer. Great, great reviews. Nobody reads my books. And when I started that book, people said to me, you know, Lisa, no one's going to read that book. No one's going to read it. And I was like, well, okay. You know, my mother said it. Our relatives said it. Other writers said it. My agent said it. My editor said it. Everybody said, no one's going to read that book. And they had all these reasons. It takes place in China. It takes place in the past. It's about women. It's about women's friendship, ew. And actually, that kind of freed me to write something in a way that I thought, well, okay, no one's going to read this, so I might as well just write exactly what I want. And I thought, well, you know, if I'm really lucky, some people will find it. You know, I had in my mind a number. I thought, if I'm really lucky, 5,000 people will find it. They'll be the right 5,000. So I went ahead and wrote it, and of course it turned out everyone was wrong, and that book was a huge, huge international bestseller. What I got out of that, and then writing Peony in Love, where these women from the 17th century, they had this belief of that you need to cut to the bone to write. That I took that, my own experience from Snowflower, and then being inspired by Peony, to continue to cut to the bone. And I may not cry when I write, but I'm not saying it's easy for me. You know, it's not easy for me to wake up in the morning and think, oh, goody, you know, I get to kill off beautiful moon today. No, it's tragic and terrible and hard, and it's very hard for me to be in that room with them. But that idea of cutting to the bone is something that has really inspired me. And then lastly, I would say On Gold Mountain, which is about my own family. And I was just recently asked to write, I'd found some new material, some new letters that we didn't know existed. And so I had sent a note to the publisher saying, you know, maybe for the 20th anniversary, I could write a new afterword. And they said, yeah, well, 20th anniversary, that's a ways off, so just call us in a couple of years. And then about 3 months later, she wrote me back and she said, you know, I've been thinking about it. Let's just do it now. And so I did write this new afterword with this new material that I had found that really changes a lot of how I thought about On Gold Mountain and my great-grandmother in particular. I don't go back and read my books. I never have. I've written them. I've gone through them 20, 30 times. But because I had to write this new afterword, I had to go back and sort of flip through and look up things. You know, what was the address in Sacramento and things like that. And I realized when I was doing that I would not be able to write that book today. You know, I was able to talk to people in my own family who, they're all gone now. You know, they're all gone. And not only could I not write that book, but I don't think anyone would be able to write anything like it because all those people are gone. For me, when I look through Dreams of On Gold Mountain, these are the people who made me the person that I am. You know, these are the people who literally gave me their stories. And I can open that and look at that and be with them. And even if no one ever bought that book, I would always have that for me in my heart. And I just found out yesterday that book that came out originally 17 years ago is going to be on the New York Times bestseller list, not this Sunday, but next Sunday. And so I think this goes back to what Celine started talking about this morning. You know, we're all on a journey, and we're all putting one foot in front of the other, and you don't know what's going to happen, but all you can really do on that journey is be true to your own heart and hope that things kind of work out around it, you know, and trust that they will. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Lisa C., best-selling author of Snowflower and the Secret Fan and Shanghai Girls. She's talked about her latest book, Dreams of Joy. Miss C. appeared as the featured speaker at the 2011 Great Conversations Luncheon, presented annually by the College of St. Mary. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, March 9, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Brittany Long, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.